No. Coming up next to the stage, the only veteran of your stories, actually. So this gentleman did our show a year ago and told a wonderful story, and I'm very happy he's back tonight. And once again, I'm going to the phone for the official introduction, which is an AIGA fellow and founder of the Essex 2 consulting firm, Joseph Michael Essex.
I'm not used to doing this kind of thing. Mostly it's because I'm talking about the work I do, not talking about my story. Usually this takes several drinks, a very big meal, and just laying around on a couch afterwards before I actually get into this kind of conversation, as other people know. In a way, my story is a little bit about design history. I graduated from college in 1970. Think about it. At the time, for those designers in the group, Phil Miggs, who wrote the book History of Design, he was in the class ahead of me. So there was no history of design before that. In 1970, I was fortunate enough to get an invitation, meaning somebody paid for me, to go to the International Design Conference in Aspen, Colorado. This conference had been in existence since 1951. It was designed and prepared by a guy named Walter Pepke. Walter Pepke was the president and chief executive officer and principal owner of the Container Corporation of America, one of the principal design organizations that actually used design in every aspect of the things they did. Walter's idea was to have a conference where design people would be there, but they were not the focus, even though it had it in the title. The focus were the business people, the educators, the mathematicians, the scientists that were also invited to this experience. And the idea was that by bringing these different groups together, these different cultures together, there was an opportunity to have them be introduced to design as process, design as a practice, legitimate practice, not necessarily a science, but something worthy of consideration. And to bring these people together. Now, he had all kinds of ideas, particularly with the speakers, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But he had an idea for lunch. There was a truck pulled up to this beautiful tent outside in Aspen, Colorado, in the Aspen Valley. Orange tent. Tent filled about 2,000 people. In the middle of the day for lunch, after the opening ceremonies and so forth for this. Open back truck. And inside the truck were boxes. Lunch boxes. Boxes of packaged goods. But the difference here was that everything in that lunchbox was one thing. One box had bread. One box had meat and cheese. Another box had condiments. Another had wine. Another had utensils. So you had to find five other people who got the different box than you. And you sat down on this beautiful grass under these great aspen trees and had lunch with people you'd never met before. Otherwise, you were eating less than the lunch you already paid for. One of the things that's interesting about the conference was that when he brought together, all of the speakers were just as diverse as those in the audience that come for this experience. They were quite, in a sense, adventuresome in their own careers and their own experiences. I'll talk a little bit about some of them later on. But one of the things that was important about this was that it was the precursor, the design conference in Aspen, for the AIGA conferences that some of the designers have gone to. And it was a significant foundation for the TED conferences. Because the guy who invented it, Richard Saul Wurman, Ricky, was on the board of directors of the International Design Conference in Aspen. So he took that and turned it into TED. And then when he sold it, he made a lot. His home in Rhode Island is incredible. I went to this conference for 13 years, the first 13 years of my career, usually because somebody else paid for it, the place I was working for. And the experience there changed my understanding of my own life, plus my life in design. The first conference I went to was, I went a day early. I didn't know what it was. I'd never been to Colorado. I'd never been to Aspen. So I went a day early. And when I got there, I started walking around, looking around what was going on. There was a tent that was already assembled. It was a giant thing. Three quarters of it are in the ground, beautiful seats and so forth. But outside of it were his crew, a bunch of locals. It's hot, it's warm, the sun is out. And these locals were shirtless, and they're erecting this sort of structure. There was an old man there, big round glasses, white snow hair, and he walked with a little kind of stutter step. And they were looking for guys to help. So I was walking around. He said, "You want to help erect this thing? We'll give you lunch." I got nothing else to do. So I started helping. I started erecting the structure, bolts that have drilled, wood that's already been drilled, bolts that had already been made, and we're sort of assembling this kind of erector set. Well, it turned out to be a geodesic dome, and the old guy was Buckminster Fuller. You have to imagine, realistically and ethically, morally, however you want to evaluate that, Buckminster Fuller is probably the quintessential Renaissance man since Da Vinci. A poet, a scholar, an inventor, a physicist, somebody who is a teacher, somebody who, in a sense, explores every aspect of himself over on a regular basis and, in a sense, reexamines every situation from the beginning, holds nothing as a fact, challenges everything as his personality. And at the same time, he does it with the most gentle, the most considerate, the most opening personality you can possibly imagine. So this was an interesting day, erecting this thing, and he was directing people as though he were a conductor with sort of a dented baton, because everything was sort of from his elbows out, gesturing in this manner. We did this thing, had a great day. When he came to make his presentation, the night of all of this, opening ceremony, the second evening of the ceremony, he was the principal speaker. He talked for 2.5 hours without stopping. And he talked in a continuous manner that you would not believe, because he addressed a great many subjects and a great many ideas that dealing with physics to futures. He talked about the fact that if you can imagine that the electronic mechanisms for, the mechanisms for capturing falling water and turning falling water into power was a fundamental consideration in this country as well as throughout the world. Well, if you think about it this way, if you were able to, in a sense, recognize that half the time that the water is falling, it's being used, turned into electricity. But the other half, it's not, because you're asleep. But the same thing is happening on the other side of the world, but in a different time frame. So if you could create a cable that would go across the North Pole, you could basically shift power one way or another, forgetting about borders and being able to manage and change the cost of power. Now, nobody was ever going to happen because of the nature of the politics and so forth. He also wrote a book called Designers and Politicians, certainly worth reading. But the nature of that idea was a demonstration of his thinking, his open platform thinking as to how he experienced the world and how he was open to that thing, to experiences. He wrote things like, "Life is the spirit incarnate in time," recognizing that there is no life without time, and time is the force or the conduit for life. "Math for the sake of math is misleading. It needs to be applied. It needs to be used. It's not a conceptual. It is an application. It is putting math into practice makes it meaningful. Dare to be naive." We've used this throughout our practice, my whole career. The idea about asking really dumb questions and not being afraid to ask them, and being appearing less than sophisticated in that regard. Buckminster Fuller is also one of the people that's credited with "less is more," even though Mies wants to took it over. But our architects are always like that. They took over the word design. You're not. They never had it before us. But there were also a lot of other people that came to this conference that were part of that. Pauline Trigier, fashion designer, old school. Pauline wanted to know what the fabric did. So when it draped across someone, she designed, not with drawings, but on the model, with scissors and pins, so that she wanted to see what the fabric did. Traditionally, fashion designers designed in a way where they drew and then constructed. Hers was about the body and the material and the nature of those materials and how they affected the body. Architect Louis Kahn, he also is famous for saying, "Even a brick wants to be somebody." He thought about the materials and the way the materials are used and how they interact with people changes the nature of those experiences with those materials. There's also George Nelson. George Nelson is an industrial designer. And George Nelson wrote a book during the late 50s called How to See. And he basically instructed, at the time it was done for the military, how to look at things. You look at a dollar bill. Did you know that the number one is in language and in numerals is on the dollar bill 12 times, at least 12 times? He talked about looking at a motorcycle engine and recognizing that those little fan parts there, they're used to escape heat. So when you really examine something, when you spend time looking at it, you not only appreciate what it looks like in context of everything else, but you recognize what it does, how it performs in the context of its overall function, which is movement. Ivan Shmaiov was another one. Ivan Shmaiov is the gentle giant. He has a great history, but he is essential to creating posters and identities with the fewest number of parts, so that he finds a way of drawing, creating, facilitating things into a way that makes it connects with people. He looks for the bare essence of whatever it is he's saying visually and turning it into a language that is understandable and accessible by a great many people. There's also people that, in a sense, you wouldn't imagine at the conference like this. You may not know of this name, Esai Hayakawa. He is a semanticist. He talks about the fact, you know, people say all the time, well, that's just semantics, meaning the words don't mean anything. He meant the words mean everything. Not only what you say, but how you say it, the nature of it, and the context of it, like poetry. The words in a particular order, in a particular sentence, not only mean what they mean, but they mean it in relationship to the words before them and after them. So when you really want to say something, you need to think about each in order, the way you're constructing a train, because it takes you from one place to another. Language has power in and of itself just by how you present it. So after all of these experiences, I've probably gone over my time anyway. One of the things that has what impressed me the most about my 13 years is that in changing my life, it did that by creating an idea of permission, giving you permission to do dumb things, to think about things in new ways, to try things and recognize that failure is part of the process, and that failure is not a negative. It is a milestone. It is a plot point when you move from one place to another. In that process, I learned three things that had been a significant part of my story. One, design by objectives. Do things in a conscious manner. Make choices, significant choices, so that you, in a sense, are consciously taking yourself from one place to another. The advantage of this design by objectives is you can bring other people with you, people who are not part of the creative process, people who, in a sense, have content, information, valued contributions, but they don't know how to articulate it or visualize them. But you collectively bring them together when you create the common denominator as the objectives you're trying to achieve. The other is design as a verb. While the first definition in the dictionary says that design is to plan, maybe it's a noun, but it doesn't become alive until you put it into action, to translate the practice into a process, and that process produces a product. And the last is content and context. There is no content without context. No matter how much information you gather, unless you can prepare, package, and present it in a way that is meaningful to the audience, to the user, to the end of whatever's going to happen with it, it in a sense falls away. It disappears as though it's one of those flowers that blows away when it gets too far along. My feeling and my experience with design as a process and a product has been sort of like the beginning and end of my personality. It's Geminian, a little confusing on occasion, but it always has a sense that you want to find the right way, right side up on occasion. So that experience with the design conference in Aspen is significant in that we have to open ourselves up, give ourselves permission to recognize that we have things to gain and to earn from a great many people who have nothing to do with what we do. And the more you open yourself up to those experiences, the more opportunity you have to do whatever you do a little better, a little smarter, and hopefully a little more fun.
Guys, I'm not a designer, just so we're all clear. I think I learned more about design in the last few minutes than I have ever known. I also learned that, I guess, designers like to eat lunch. There was a lot of lunch going on in that story. Maybe I could be a designer. I don't know. Do you guys have room for one more?